Who here has been to one of my workshops on dating and relationship and marriage before? Somebody asked me this morning if I was going to say the same things that I've said before. And I said, well, what did you hear me say before? And he said, I can't remember. And I said, then it'll all be new. As you know, I'm from New York City. And in New York City, we like to think that we work hard and play hard. You've heard of that, right? New York City, we work hard and we play hard. And probably there's nobody who works harder and is more known for being a real hard worker in New York City than the Donald, right? Donald Trump. Well, when one of his marriages was on the rocks, somebody suggested to him that he should get into marriage counseling. And the Donald said, marriage should not be work. Now, if the Donald doesn't think that marriage should be work, and yet certainly work should be work, right, and play should be work, that's pretty serious. Show me a couple who doesn't think that they have to work at relationship, and I'll show you a couple of corpses. Because every relationship requires work. From the beginning, you cannot just experience that high limerent phase at the very beginning when, you know, you can't catch your breath and you can't eat and sleep and because all you do is think about that person. Is that person going to call me? That's in that high fantasy phase. Especially at that point, you must work hard, or else it's not going to work. You either work or it won't work. Now, a couple of weeks ago I was over in London and I did a weekend on what I'm going to try and let you know today. And it took them a whole weekend of sessions, and I think some of them got some of it. I told some of my clients in New York City who've been coming to me for years, I was going to go to London and do this in a weekend. And they said, good luck. And then now I'm going to try and do it in a few minutes with you. Don't chastise yourself if you don't quite get everything I say or you have some misunderstandings or something, but ask questions and we'll just try to get some things clarified. But I think that one of the things that has been helpful, and I've been doing this for over 30 years in New York City with just run-of-the-mill gay people as well as straight couples. One of the helpful things, I think, is just the idea that there is some rational thought that can be put to the whole matter of dating, because dating and romantic interest and so forth is experienced at such a non or irrational level, right? It's just an involuntary response and it's emotional and so forth. And so I think a lot of people have thought, well, they just have to cross their fingers and hope for the best and hopefully something somehow will work out. But there's actually a more scientific way of going about it, a more rational way of going about it, that can stave off unnecessary hurt and stave off unnecessary time wasted and go more directly and efficiently and effectively toward the meeting of the real need that you have. If it were not rather difficult, there would be a lot more successful relationships than there are. One of the the reasons that there are so relatively few successful relationships, heterosexual or gay, is that people have never really understood the fact that if they want a workable relationship, they have to understand what in the world is the need and how can I get from where I am to where I need to be to meet the need. Now, the need is not for genital nerve ending stimulation. Everyone in this room is capable of doing his or her own genital nerve ending stimulation. But you want something more than that, right? And so... Yes. Now you can be the guinea pig for everybody else. Everybody else now, you know, turn this off, turn them off. So, you don't need, the need is not simply for genital nerve ending stimulation. The need is for whole person connection with another whole person. Not only can you do your own genital nerve ending stimulation by yourself, but it doesn't matter whether or not your partner is a man or a woman, right? Still have nerve ending stimulation. But if you really want to fulfill your need, whether your orientation is homosexual or your orientation is heterosexual, it requires having the appropriate partner. Certainly the appropriate partner means, at the very least, having one who is of the gender that is appropriate to your orientation. And it gets more complicated from there. I titled the talk, the initial talk in London, Every Couple Needs Three Legs. And this was only partly done to get attention. But hopefully, by saying every couple needs three legs, it'll help you remember what those three legs are. Because the three legs are three legs of a stool. If you did well in physics, you'll know that a three-legged stool is a very steady thing. A four-legged stool is not. A two-legged stool is not. A one-legged stool is not. Most people are trying to have a one-legged stool and the seat's flying around and doesn't work. You need three legs. Two won't do, one won't do. Two out of three ain't bad, won't do. You need the three legs of the stool. And the three legs of the stool, I'll give them to you now, all three, and then we'll talk a little bit about each one, and then we'll open it up for conversation. One of the legs of the stool that is absolutely necessary for a successful relationship, that is romantic relationship, whether heterosexual or homosexual, is that there has to be, and all of these three things are matters of shared, mutual elements. There have to be shared, imprinted responses to the fascinating otherness of the other person. That really is what sexual orientation is all about. The only people we fall in love with are people that we perceive. It doesn't matter whether anybody else perceives them this way or not. What's important is how we perceive. The only kind of person, the only individual that you'll ever fall in love with and that you have ever felt fallen in love with, and you think about this, is someone that you perceive as, in one sense, very much not me. Right? Now, you cannot, beyond that, itemize them, because it is an involuntary, imprinted response. Very early established, probably a combination of genetic and social factors, we don't know. But it is already set very early. So that when you think back on the first crushes you had in school, that other individual, as you recall, was very much somebody that you perceived as not just another me, right? And of course not other in the sense of weird, but fascinatingly other, right? Not just any otherness will do. The person has to be fascinatingly other. Now you see, this immediately throws away this crazy notion of my type. Nobody has a type. If you think you do, and you name one element in that type, I'll line up 10 or 15 other people who indeed literally have that thing going for him or her, because descriptively, you know. You say, no, that's not what I had in mind. So throw away the idea that you have a type. It's just a persona. It's a gestalt. It's a whole. And it is either there or it isn't. Now, it might be something that you recognize immediately upon seeing this ink blot across the room. Or it might take a little bit of time, because sometimes the visually mediated imprint does take place instantaneously upon sighting the person. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that it's going to be sustained, because maybe 5 minutes later you hear the person talking. I had a male client tell me that during the gay pride parade, he was walking down the street and he saw this person up ahead of him, and he was so excited, you know, and he started following this person, and at the intersection, the person turned around and he's a lesbian. Immediately, the imprinted persona was blown away, see? Now, if you are attracted to somebody that you see, but then that person speaks and then it just destroys the sense that you had of who this is, visually the person still looks the same, right? Mm-hmm. And you might even say the person is handsome or, you know, what, cute. But it just was destroyed. But that's important, to allow that to happen so that you don't follow the wrong person, you see, down the street. So that imprinted fascination with another individual who is perceived to be the very otherness of myself. Because, see, none of us can fall in love with himself or herself. None of us can. But we constantly make the mistake of trying to figure out what our chances are by looking in the mirror and saying, would anybody want me? Of course, you're asking the wrong person. Because it's impossible to find fascinating otherness in yourself, in your sense of self, right? The only way that you could find fascinating otherness in your sense of self is if you were starting to experience some serious short-term memory problem. Could you hold it just for a second? So, So you don't have to worry about how you're coming across, because your sexiness is brought to the situation through the eyes and the brain and the imprinting of the other person. See, I often say, for example, there are no such things as homosexuals and heterosexuals. There are just, let's see, there are just datasexuals and timosexuals and penisexuals and so forth. You see? And if somebody is not a davisexual, Dave should forget about, you know, trying to, you know, do anything to get this person interested, you know. Maybe if Dave just, you know, went and pumped up, or Dave tried to increase his vocabulary, or, you know, whatever, it won't work. Piece of paper from the lozenger. Anyway. So it just won't work. But isn't it a relief that your sexiness is there in the mind of the other person? And if that person is not imprinted to what he or she experiences of you, then forget it. Your need is not going to be met with that individual. It's going to be hell if you try. So move on. Okay? Because there are people who have been imprinted to what they see in you. So that's the first one. And of course, it has to be mutual. Some people, they extrapolate from their sense of self and they get themselves so discouraged that nobody is ever going to want them, that somebody comes along and wants them, oh, and they'll say yes. Even if they're not attracted to the person. That's a mistake. Has to be mutual. The second leg, absolutely necessary, is shared values. Now, what do I mean by shared values? I mean, whatever is a big deal to the one has to be a big deal to the other. They don't have to necessarily be nice things. In other words, two bank robbers share values. And they'd probably be better able to have a successful relationship than the bank robber and the sheriff. See? Like the Bonnie and Clyde thing. See? They have to share values. What's a big deal? And this is, of course, where your Christian faith and discipleship comes in, because if you're very serious about your discipleship and it's a very important thing to you, but then because of your misuse of your own sense of self, you get yourself discouraged that no Christian's ever going to be interested in me, so I'll just take whoever comes along, and that person is either indifferent to Christian faith or is even perhaps hostile. How are you going to meet your intimacy needs when intimacy means closeness, right? And if some of the most important stuff in your life you can't share, that's going to be a very isolating experience. See? And some of you perhaps know from sad experience that that is the case. And you can't say, well, you know, one of these days the Lord will bring them around. That's what we psychologists call rationalization. Right? Okay, shared values. Now sometimes it looks like, well, some people who are successfully related, they don't share values. Like, you know, some people then tell me, oh, but I know a couple, they don't share political values. Mary Madeline and James Carville. How can you say they share values, right? Well, they may not share values defined in a certain way, although who knows, but what they do share is a real hunger and love for politics, right? So the fact that one works for the left and one book works for the right is really immaterial. They share a love of the fight. Okay, and the third leg of the stool . Let's hear it for Darlene.
That's not the way you smack
him. Ah, but Darlene, it'll work every time. Anyway, the third leg of the stool is, and this has to be both, the will and the skill at teamwork. It will not work if both people do not share both the willingness and the ability to be team players. And again, maybe in your own personal history or in other situations that you know of, people have gone through a lot of heartache because they did not take seriously enough either their own lack of ability or even their lack of willingness or the other person's lack of ability or willingness to work as a team. Because inevitably things get taxing and get difficult, and you need a team player to work things through. Now, if you haven't heard me say these three things before, do you have some sense that, well, maybe it's both not so complicated as I thought, or not so chancy as I thought, but also more complicated than I thought? Well, that's good, because you can waste a lot of time going after the wrong person. Most people, of course, go after somebody only because that person strikes their fancy visually, or, you know, they're just that sense, that fantasy of the person. Well, you cannot have a successful relationship with a fantasy. You know, go after Casper the Friendly Ghost or something. But you cannot have an actual, real, live relationship with a fantasy. Do you ever notice that fantasies always are all unmixed anyway, right? Anything that, you know, you want to go to see a movie, and then you can get disappointed, right? Because you thought it was going to be better than it was. You should go to movies that you don't think are going to be any good. Then you can be pleasantly surprised. But we go after something because we think it's going to be good. But you have to be very careful, because it's very dangerous. Obviously, that's what people are going to do. They're going to go after something that they hope is going to be good, and they think is going to be good, whether it's a movie or a conference or whatever. But keep in mind that a fantasy is unmixed. And so if you think it's going to be good, it's going to be unmixed good. And you're setting yourself up for a disappointment. A lot of people will leave this conference and they'll be griping because, it wasn't, you know, this I didn't like. And then, of course, some people who couldn't make it, they still have the unmixed bag good fantasy. It's like, look what I missed. You see? That's the way you are with some boyfriends or girlfriends that never got to be your boyfriend or girlfriend, right? The one who got away. Wouldn't that have been a wonderful relationship? See? Because you never did have a relationship with anything but your fantasy of that person. And some of you know that fantasies can turn into nightmares, right? But there are fewer opportunities for fantasies to turn into nightmares when you go into the thing with your eyes open, your ears open, and you know, some of my clients, they say, well, they went to a mixer or on the Planet Out or something like that, and they had a coffee date, and they decided at the end of the coffee date that this person wasn't for them. And I said, great, successful screening. Okay? See? So whether you screen the person in or out, it's a successful screening. What is not a successful screening is if you blind yourself to the red flags that are flying just because you think, oh, he's so cute. Well, who here has found out that cute can get old pretty fast? Yeah. Right? Even some stuff that was very cute to begin with. Belching. When he belches, it's so cute. But after a while, no. See? In that high limerent phase, the person can do no wrong, right? After a while, the person can do no right. That's what's so important about screening well. Well, anyway, those are the three things. We'll open it up for discussion and see if you see what you think.
I'm thinking about my parents' relationship. They got divorced after 20 years of marriage. I remember when we went to family counseling and the therapist would ask my parents, you know, why are you here? My mom would talk about issues that were of concern to her, and my dad would just say, oh, well, I don't have any problems. She's the one that wanted to come here. So I was thinking about your concept of willingness and ability to recognize that it's a team effort. He didn't seem to, I don't know if he couldn't or wouldn't, but he always just, and then after they were divorced, you know, he used me as the middleman and, tell your mother I still love her, I miss her, I want to get back with her. And it's like, what can I do, you know? So I agree with that, because I saw that firsthand in my parents' relationship. He wasn't willing to do anything, and yet he wanted, you know, I think he wanted a fantasy life.
And, of course, once the person is out of our life, you know, there are two old adages, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But then the other side of that coin is what? Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? Mm-hmm. Why does absence make the heart grow fonder?
I don't know.
Huh? There's plenty of room for fantasy. Yeah? No reality check on a daily basis. Yeah.
So, I kind of just stuck at the beginning of your talk about the whole person connecting with another whole person. And so right now I'm just kind of working on my whole person. How do you recognize somebody else is a whole person, or do you just kind of magically see that when you become a whole person?
Well, I think maybe you are taking a little different meaning to my use of the term whole person.
Okay.
I simply meant more whole as in gestalt. In other words, just a persona,
okay,
a sense of the entire individual. Mm-hmm. And so that sense of the other persona is experienced by you as a sense of basically not me. You know, you have a self concept, and of course it is just your self concept. It's just a little idea in your brain about yourself. Doesn't say that it's true or out there for anybody else or anything like that. It's in your brain. But the sense of the other guy in your head is a complementary thing to your sense of self. So. Yeah?
Given that you had the first two legs of your stool intact, can you you talk in concrete terms about teamwork and maybe practical suggestions on building?
Well, I mean, just like he was saying, if one says, you know, we need to talk, and the other one says, well, what's there to talk about, you know? I mean, even if the second one doesn't think there's anything to talk about, if the first one thinks there is, then there is. Okay? And so the willingness to be up for really listening and hearing where my partner is, you know? Now, remember that I said the only people we fall in love with are the fascinatingly other from ourselves. That means basically that the only people we fall in love with are people whose personalities are very different from ours. You might, in some stereotypical ways, say that you tend to be a more quiet person, or you tend to be a more gregarious person. If you look at those to whom you have been fascinatingly drawn, you'll find that if you tend to be a kind of quiet person, you're drawn to people who are more extroverted, right? And the other direction. So that to the extent that the person that you are imprinted to is a very different personality from your own, it's going to require a lot of work, because the other person doesn't think the same way. The other person's timing isn't the same. Sometimes the person says to me, well, she doesn't care. And all that person really is talking about is, my partner does not show caring the way I would show caring. Think of all the times that you have said or heard somebody say, well, I certainly wouldn't have done it that way. Or if I wanted to show, you know, that I appreciate it, I would have, you know, blah, blah, blah. See? Well, that's a big mistake. You have to learn, and this is part of the teamwork, and you have to learn the other person's language. The other person doesn't talk your language. You have to learn the other person's language. You have to learn to hear the other person's language. Because the other person talks a foreign language. The other person is an alien. We fall in love only with aliens. So you have to learn the other person's language, and you have to then speak the other person's language. And the other person, of course, has to be doing it the other way. That's why there's mutual. But it goes without saying, it's going to be difficult, because we do fall in love with very different people from ourselves. And so we cannot go into ourselves and say, well, what would it mean if I just sat around? You know, I mean, sometimes you see somebody, what's wrong? You haven't been talking, you haven't said anything for 15 minutes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of hearing what almost sounds like a contradiction. In one way, you're saying opposites attract, but then you're also talking about we have to have shared values. It almost sounds like it's contradicting each other.
Okay. We have to have values in common, but we are drawn to the fascinating other personality. Personality is not the same as values. Even interests aren't the same as values. A person, one person can be interested in soccer, and the other person doesn't have any interest in soccer, and that's fine, unless the person who's interested in soccer eats, drinks, and sleeps soccer. Then it's not any longer an interest, it is a value. Well, it's a value. See? And there you have to have values that are in sync, you see, common values. But if it's just an interest, well, you know, while you go off to your soccer game, I'll go to my knitting class, whatever. See? But if, you know, I just follow the knitting circuit all over the country, go to knitting conferences and knitting, you know, then, you know, forget it. Yeah.
Our marriage is made in heaven. In other words, does God have a stake in these human relationships?
Well, I wouldn't say that marriages are made in heaven in the old superstitious way that people talk about it. But I would say that God is interested in your meeting your needs for intimacy, which he has constructed in us, and he wants us to use the brains that we have and the good sense that we have and the experience and the mistakes that we've made to learn from those mistakes and to go about it in the most reasonable and loving way we can. And if we do, then we'll either find somebody that is compatible and can meet our intimacy needs, and we can meet that person's intimacy needs, or we won't meet such an individual, which is fine. Much better not to meet that individual than to meet the wrong one. Who here has learned that? Yeah. See? Better to go home at the end of the workday to an empty apartment than to an apartment with some grump, right? No. Nobody else does either. I mean, it just...
What is the imprinting?
The imprinting, he said.
Oh, the imprinting.
The imprinting, yeah. Nobody knows. In fact, in a sense, we understand maybe homosexual orientation a little better than heterosexual, because in most cases we understand disease more than health, you know, that kind of idea, because more study been done. But I mean, this is one of the things I think that is important to recognize, that while there may be, I mean, there definitely is some sort of a confluence of heredity and environment, there's not going to be a gay gene discovered or anything like that. You know, it's much too complicated for that. If there had been a gay gene all along, first of all, what in the world would it mean, gay? Because what we experience in the 21st century as the falling in love phenomenon was not experienced in the ancient world, either the biblical world or the classical world or something, anything like that. So that's why you don't find any homosexuality in the Bible or in the ancient world at all. You found some same gender behavior going on, but it was within the context of understanding and experience and so forth, was totally outside of our own experience. In the ancient world, parents picked your partner, and it was basically families marrying into families, and it was economic and all kinds of stuff like that. So, but the falling in love phenomenon is essentially a post-early Middle Ages phenomenon, and requires a certain amount of leisure time, a certain amount of, it's just a different thing. But we don't understand exactly what it is. Even in some cultures today that have not been so heavily influenced by Western civilization do not experience quite the same phenomenon. Yeah?
I have a question. Probably it's hard to answer, maybe impossible, but you're in a relationship, you have 1, 2, and 3 down pat. A few years goes by, one member backs out of a change. Values are no longer there, no longer willing to work as a team. Is it acceptable to get out once those 3 steps are no longer there, or is it something you just work at even if the other partner is not willing, or work even if the other partner has changed?
You cannot single-handedly do the work of 2 people. You cannot, and you must not set yourself up for trying to do the work of 2 people. If you could do the work of 2, you wouldn't even need a partner. And you have to put 100% of your effort in, and the other person has to put 100% of his or her effort in. And if the other person, for whatever reason, isn't up for it, then it's not going to fly. And the best thing to do is to, as gracefully get out of it. But I think that if, for example, the refusal to work on the relationship is coming out of maybe pessimism on the person's part, on somebody's part, we can't resolve this or something. Well, let's see if we can. And of course, then the willingness to work, say in a couple counseling or something like that, is very important. Unfortunately, and sadly, most marriage counseling is terrible. I would say virtually all gay marriage counseling is terrible.
Why?
Because of the stupidity of the therapists. the pop psych stuff that they've swallowed. I've had people come to me, and they've been to other therapists, and they said, well, it doesn't seem to be working out. We went to this other therapist, and he said we should have a threesome. That would bring spice into our religion. Hello? The very problem that they were encountering, which is what I call incest taboo, the threesome reinforced the problem. It did not solve the problem. It made it worse. For example, in our sex-negative society, where sex is bad, dirty, we don't talk about family sex, Don't talk about our parents having sex, even though we are the example of at least once they had sex. But still, even our own presence in the world is a bit uncomfortable, and we don't want to think about our mother lubricating and our father. So, you take that sex negativity in our heads on one side, and then in the gay world, all the emphasis on anonymous sex and hot sex and novelty sex and not just in the gay world and not just in porno, but in just regular movies. When did you last see a sex scene, that is two people kissing or anything like that, in a regular movie that was not being done by two people who had just basically met? Did you ever see such a scene between people who have been married to each other, not married, married to each other for more than a day? So that this idea that somehow it's very difficult then to continue, when we first date and when we first meet, we're posturing, right? Whatever that means to you. Doing, putting the best foot forward and so forth. Don't even know if the other person's in defeat. But anyway. But you try to make a good impression. But after a while, you get the impression, I can't continue to hold my stomach in. He's seen me with my hair up in curlers and all and so forth. So how can I continue to present myself as a sex object? And so I stop presenting myself as a sex object, and then of course there's personalizing going on the other side, and so when that person stops, and pretty soon they're not having sex, and then they hear that, well, you can't expect sex to last, and so have a little arrangement so you have an open relationship and all that. And it's only just deteriorates down. No such arrangements ever work. They don't work. Because in this society, we still have expectations for parity. In a society, say, where you have one man and several wives, and those are the expectations of everybody, well then, I suppose that would work a little better with less jealousy and so forth, but even there, in those older societies, or in Mormon societies, there's still jealousy among the wives and so forth. See? So, it's very difficult to find some good therapy. You know, or this is something superficial like, you know, take a bubble bath or something.
So if we're looking for that other thing, then in many ways we're looking for someone with qualities that kind of bring something to the relationship that makes you more complete.
Yes, but don't misunderstand that you don't have to look for the otherness.
No.
Yeah, it just
right.
hits you. Yeah.
But if it works, it's actually that you're better.
Well, there's a yeah, I'm not sure I would say you're better. I'm just saying that the thing that meets the need is then present in your life. Yes, the thing that meets that need. And if you don't find such an individual, then that part is going to, there's going to be an empty part in your life. Now, that doesn't mean that then your life's not worth living or anything like that. But if at times you have that sense of the absence, then, well, that makes sense. Know what's going on instead of, you know, don't try and meet that need then by, you know, a quick fix kind of thing. Yeah. A quick fix is quick, but it ain't no fix.
Ross, question yeah. for you on clear the term. I'm just kind of dovetailing on what Gregory said, actually, about being a whole person, or the word healthy. And sometimes we hear, well, you know, when I get healthy, then I can get in a relationship. And could you maybe address what healthy is? And is that just a cop-out? And
if what was the phrase? If I want to get healthy?
I'm not whole yet, or when I get healthy, I can get into a relationship.
Oh.
Talking about, you know, emotional.
Yeah. Whatever. Well, I'll tell you. You know, I'll tell you. Don't think that, for example, these three things that I'm talking about are things that you must only think, well, now, somebody that I meet, does this person qualify? Do I qualify? Am I up for being willing and able to be a team player? See? And I think some people, to be brutally honest with themselves, have to think, maybe I'm not mature enough to be a team player. And I shouldn't inflict myself and my narcissism and my self-centeredness and so forth on somebody else until I am healthier. Yeah. And I think some people, when they're dissatisfied with their lives, maybe they don't like their work, for example. Well, you can't solve work problems by getting into a relationship any more than you can solve a relationship problem by going to work. See? So it is important to be as healthy as possible and to continue to work on yourself, psychologically and spiritually and to have flow in work, that, you know, to flow, concept of flow in work is of just, you know, the time goes flying because you just love the doing of the thing. So anything that you can do to make your life better, you're making the life better to bring to somebody else. Yeah?
I'm just curious to hear your comments on, I have my own issues about the political nature of gay marriage, and I think sometimes gay people think that if we're allowed to have rights and get married, that all of a sudden these gay people are going to get married and have these long-term relationships, and I don't see that happening. I don't see that the gay community having the ability and the skills to support gay marriages so that they last.
Well, I think that it's an individual matter. There are some gay people who, in fact, without legal marriage, do have lasting relationships that are successful. And there are some heterosexual couples that don't do such a good job, even with the legal privilege and so forth. But I do agree with you that so much, in so many ways, and for various historical reasons, gay couples have not had a good track record. But I think that anything that can be done to stabilize a relationship is very important. Help people get through a bowel movement or something. You know. people are constipated and they think that something's wrong with their lover. Please.
Let me follow up on that. Given that legal marriage is an option, what can we do outside that structure to stabilize?
Well, I think that the best thing to do is to screen in the terms that we've talked about, because I think a lot of people with the privilege of marriage today do not screen on this basis. You know, so you can do a lot for yourself by screening the right one in and the wrong one out, and to do so. And let family members, who are supportive of you, or friends, check this person out, whoever, you introduce somebody that you had a date with or something, you introduce to your friends, and basically their attitude is, what are you thinking? Well, pay attention to them, because they may not be seeing the person through your imprinted response, they may be seeing the person through just some basic common sense. Yeah.
I don't think I'm able to word this well, but...
What?
I don't think I'm going to be able to word this well, but I guess when I think about what you have to say about this imprinted thing inside of us, that we're just attracted to whatever it may be, I get confused because I've seen in my own experience that it changes. Like, it seems to, the things I'm attracted to, for example, there's this guy that I just had this huge crush on for the longest time, and it turned out he had a boyfriend and blah, blah, blah. But then I found myself being attracted to someone else, but I realized it was because there was something about this other person who I'd been attracted to, and it sort of, it reminded me of that, sort of. But
well, that's the imprint.
But it's I don't know. Yeah, I don't.
In other words, there's something, and don't even try to put a name on it. Don't even try to figure it out or label it or think, what is it? You just had a sense that something that drew me to him drew me also to him, right?
Yeah, but it was different things. Like, the thing that drew me to the first person was... initially, it wasn't just, like, this physical thing. Initially, I wasn't attracted to him. And then, as I got to know him and the way that he carried himself and his, stuff like this, and then I was just like, wow, this person's amazing.
Exactly.
And so, then I became more physically attracted.
Yes.
So then with this other person, it was more of just, like, I had this physical attraction to a feature that they had that was similar to this other person. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
You're saying with your words what I'm saying. In other words, it was not a physical, it wasn't a body part, or it wasn't an occupation, or it was, there was just a sense of this guy.
The first guy.
And sometimes that takes some time. In other words, you can see somebody if you're in a particular organization and you've seen the person several times. And then just the more you spend time with that person, you hear them talking and see them moving, and just something hits you, Well, that's the imprint. It doesn't just happen immediately on first sight. then because of your disappointment that that didn't go anyplace, maybe then you rather woodenly locked on to something that you identified more cognitively as a feature of this other guy. But of course, it was a disembodied kind of just little feature thing, you see. Make sense?
Yeah. I've done hundreds of marriages in my career, and sometimes they're first-time marriages. Sometimes it's the fifth or sixth marriage for somebody. But I wonder, do you have any thoughts on what seems to be that some people basically are very monogamous, and other people seem to be polygamous?
Some people are very what?
Monogamous, you know. They just settle for one person, and that's it. And then there are other people, and they keep moving on.
Well, I'm sure there are as many reasons for it as there are people doing it. You know, some people are monogamous because just they're too scared to do it otherwise. That doesn't mean that they should do it otherwise. It just means that it's, you know, they're just too scared, which is not particularly a virtue, you know. Not straying out of fear is not necessarily a virtue. There are all kinds of reasons. I would say an awful lot of people do genital things, and I say genital rather than even sexual, because sexual is more broad, do genital things for non-genital reasons, or certainly non-sexual reasons. You know, they're just dissatisfied with their work, or the, you know, it's like somebody sent me a cartoon on my email the other day, and it was like an ice cream store that had different kinds of ice cream, but instead of like strawberry and chocolate and stuff, it was like broken relationship flavor and lost my job flavor. In other words, people turn for inappropriate reasons to sex, or to food, or to, you know, whatever.
I've got a question about, it kind of dovetails with the gentleman in the back row, what he was talking about a minute ago. Is it critical, in your view, when you're having an initial date with someone, that you experience that some might call it chemistry, or, you know, that this person is fascinatingly other? And is it critical that you experience that kind of, that you have that emotional component? Or is it okay if you know, maybe you have some prior knowledge of this person, you know, maybe friends know this person that you're now dating, you know that they have the same value system. You know that there are strong shared values. And is it okay, you know, thinking that, well, you know, the physical aspect or that physical attraction may grow over a period of time, so I'm going to continue to date this person for a couple of weeks or a month or 2 months or whatever? Or, you know, the other way of looking at that is that you're kind of, in a sense, leading them on. Do you know what I'm saying here?
Actually, you're leading yourself on as much as you're leading the other person on. Because when you say to yourself, well, I'm not, you know, really going all weak in the knees over this person, but he does have good values. How much consideration did you give to Mother Teresa? See?
Yeah.
She had good values. So, in other words, I'm saying, All three legs of the stool have to be there. Now, nothing wrong with if you're not sure, you know, I'm not repulsed. And he does have good values and so on. So we can go on another coffee date, you know. Yeah. Several months, no. No. I mean, you're only misleading yourself because, you know, in part, it's the pessimism. It's the idea of, well, I'm not going to be able to find somebody, you know, where all three things happen. So, and then, you know, you start to pick up the idea, you know, like, well, and, you know, after a while, nobody continues to have sex anyway. And, you know, so, and I don't want to grow old by myself. And so you talk yourself into making a big, bad, dumb mistake that involves another individual. So you have to pay attention to your imprinted response, and see, there's a danger in the other direction. If you're very heavily imprinted, then, I didn't like what he said about that, and didn't like, you know, that what he just told me about. But, oh well, you can't have everything. No. You'll pay at some point for the mistake. Who here has paid for a mistake? You know, you just, and who knew, you know, I mean, who crashed the red light? You know, my goodness, where did that come from? It wasn't that, right? You knew.
You knew in the beginning.
But you wouldn't let yourself know it.
Yeah.
See? And that is a big mistake. Yeah?
With that, what's the fine line with, you know, nobody's perfect, but you have to learn to live. If you fall in love with a specific person and you know there's different ways about them, it's like, not everybody's perfect. Where's that fine line? And where does it waver as to, you knew, so you shouldn't have?
Well, because the idea of nobody's perfect, what I'm advocating here is not that you be picky. Some people never get into a relationship because they're too picky. You know, they're looking for example, a certain aesthetic look. And if the person couldn't get hired as a model, then they don't want them. Well, what's that about? That's not about imprinting. That's about needing a trophy to make myself feel good in the eyes of other people. See? So I'm not advocating being picky, but it's not picky to say, we both have to be attracted to each other. We have to share what is really a big deal, values. And we have to both be up for the hard work that is inevitable if we're going to have a successful relationship. And that's really, you know, because you can't just have the willingness. Plenty of people say, I have good intentions, right? Who here ever thought he didn't have good intentions? Right? Everybody here has good intentions, right? Mm-hmm. Who here thinks you really do have the skill to be in a relationship? Anybody? You really do have the skill. Who has the will to have the skill? If you have the will to have the skill, then you can learn the skill, but you cannot muster up the will if you don't have it.
At what point in a relationship, and that is like a timeline or a phase in the relationship, do you feel like, or can you comment on that couple being ready to make a permanent commitment to each other.
When they have screened each other in these three terms and have come to the conclusion that, you know, they can sign off on all these three things.
But I mean, you can sign off those things in like the first week or,
I don't think you can sign off on them on the first week, because don't forget, if there is imprinted, mutual imprinting, even if there's only one-sided imprinting, there's a lot of posturing going on. You can't trust that posturing.
Like some people will say, like the first 3 years of a relationship are like a nesting phase, or
and then it's hell bad after that.
When are they?
What fresh hell do we have today?
How do you know that when you're past the posturing?
Well, you better start to gain some interpersonal skills to pick it up, because it's inevitable that there will be posturing in the first few days or weeks. It's inevitable if you're imprinted to the person. Who here? You're imprinted to the person and you just run your best behavior. So attentive. So cool. So what? Oh yes. Afraid to laugh. Yeah. So you better learn how to pick up on the posturing, because it's not, you know. I mean, one of the ways to, you know. Don't be afraid of finding some faults, you know, in your own head with the person. You don't have to mention them. But, you know, I mean, I always say the only person that you meet is a stranger, right? And the stranger will get stranger before that person gets more familiar. But if the stranger does not get stranger, then there's something wrong. You're holding yourself hostage to your original fantasy. Right? If you don't start to see some things that, I didn't realize that. Now, these are not red flag issues. They're not deal breakers. But if you don't start to see some little, maybe irritating habits of this person, don't forget, there's an alien. They don't do things in his or her family like they do in my family, right? My goodness, they open Christmas presents on Christmas Eve. Christmas isn't even here yet. You think that's funny? Destroys the whole holiday season. Yeah.
It seems to me that heterosexual marriage, of course, has big support from society. And obviously, gay marriage does not. Do you think that the gay and lesbian community has a better chance if they build a support system?
Oh, yes.
Because that...
Well, it has to be a good support system, but it...
Right.
Yes, right. That's why I'm for gay marriage, and unfortunately, you know, in the one state which has ruled for legal gay marriage, John Kerry wants to throw it out. I simply mentioned that to give equal time.
This is his week.
Yeah.
If you one of your values is individualism and the other person's value is individual as well, could you not have a variety of relationships that have one and two and not necessarily choose to have three?
I'm not sure I understand the question. If your value is individualism...
To be an individual and not a member of a team.
Oh, well, that's not a value. I mean, that's a value. That is a value, but it is a killer where you need a team. In other words, if you say, well, this guy, you know, he can pitch a ball and he can catch and all, but he's no team player, but we ought to hire him for the team anyway. Yeah. Okay. In other words, for something that requires a team, and if somebody is in it only for himself. See, one of the common complaints in relationships often, people say, well, what's in this for me anymore? You know, right? I'm not getting my needs met. Right? Who here has ever heard anybody say that? Not yourself, but somebody else. I'm not getting my needs met. What about me? You can't take that attitude. If you're going to be up for a marriage, the question has to be never, what's in this for me? Always, what's in this for us? If you don't have a mentality that asks at every point, what's in this for us? I mean, think of the straying into promiscuity and so that would never have occurred if the person who was tempted to have sex outside the relationship asked, and what's in this for us? Obviously, wouldn't have been done. It's done, the person goes outside the relationship, because the person is just thinking, what's in this for me? And rationalizing it by saying, well, the other person doesn't give a damn about me anymore. Not meet my needs. So I have to go out and meet my own needs. Because I'm an individual and I have a right to meet my needs and all that kind of stuff, you see? As a matter of fact, the whole concept of rights can be very dangerous in a relationship. Because the idea of individual rights can be counter to the individual, to the communal rights, you see, of the relationship. And yet, especially today, and in the gay movement and in things at large in general, we tend to filter things through that idea of individual rights. And so we have to sort of be countercultural about that. That should not be hard for Christians, but it is very hard for Christians. Because whether we're Christians on the right or Christians on the left, the tendency is not to think in terms of being countercultural.
Sex too soon. If you meet somebody, is there any roadmap bridge that you should kind of wait, or is it just depending on the situation, or do we sexualize it too soon?
Well, most gay men do genitalize too soon. I mean, that's why I use the term genitalizing and sexual. Genitalizing, actually, you know, doing something behaviorally, is done in most cases too soon. And not too soon merely in more abstract moral terms, but too soon psychologically and too soon sociologically. When you think that there is no relating that is more intimate than the sexual relating and how it has been trivialized, people will walk into a room and start to do genital things with somebody that if they walked into an ice cream parlor and there were a bunch of stools sitting along the counter,
and somebody was sitting over there, they wouldn't go over and sit beside the person, right? They want some stools between them, right? We have a kind of a sense of
personal space.
So to the extent that people have gone too far, too fast, whether they wish to or not, whether they wish against the unintended consequences or not, there are unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences are that we have violated a basic human distance. So what has happened? We won't ask for personal testimonies, but you've perhaps heard that very often when strangers have sex, they don't want to look at each other after that. Two people might cruise each other in the supermarket several times. Every time they're in there and they see the other one and they cruise and look and then they pick each other up and they have sex. And then since the supermarket is in the neighborhood, lo and behold, a couple days later, they're both in there and one heads to frozen food and the other one heads to produce, right? Pretending they don't even see each other. Because they have violated that distance. So it's clear that gay men, especially, have gone too far, too fast, repeatedly. And by doing so, they have also reinforced the incest taboo, so that the powerful behavioral reinforcer of orgasm in the brain has linked orgasm and novelty or anonymity, which makes it so much more difficult then, eventually, to have a robust sexual genital life in an ongoing relationship, in a familial relationship, see? Because sex doesn't belong in the family. It belongs outside with anonymous people and so forth, you see? So the more we reinforce in our brain, and it's an actual behavioral, very strong behavioral reinforcer, of that linkage between orgasm and anonymity, we are doing ourselves a horrible injustice in terms of being able to sustain a lively sex life in our ongoing relationship eventually when we have it. So the answer then to the question is, since the need, as when I began, I said, what is the need? The need is to meet your romantic intimacy need, right? Need is not to have an orgasm. You have an orgasm by yourself. So how soon should we have an orgasm? Well, the need is not for the orgasm. The need is to screen somebody for an ongoing meeting of that more fundamental, deeper need that is sexual. So premature genitalizing only screws it up. Not to mention, of course, STDs and so forth. Yeah?
So, where have you been, you know, my entire 8 years now that I've come out now? Oh, sure, now somebody tells me.
By the way, I do therapy on the phone.
You will be leaving your number. No. Is that repairable? I mean, can you?
No, it is repairable, but it is repairable, but the best thing you can do from now on is not to reinforce the damaging way. And for example, some people might think, well, this is inappropriate to talk about, but even in matters of masturbating. And by the way, who here was that connection when old Charlie Shedd was here as a keynoter? Do you remember Charlie? He just died in May, 88 years old. Charlie Shedd, for those of you, have you ever heard of Charlie Shedd?
I've heard the name this week, but I don't know anything.
Charlie Shedd and his wife Martha were among the first evangelical writers to write about, you know, Christian masturbation and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that, and wrote best-selling books, letters to his daughter, letters to Philip, and letters to Karen, and Brushed by an Angel, and so forth. And he was a best-selling author, made millions of dollars, writing a real character. And but anyway, I'm talking about masturbation, and there he was, you know, in the 50s, he and his wife writing such books. You know. And he was such a character. I have to tell you that in the Q&A section with him out at the Eastern Connection, somebody, well, he was answering some question, and of course he was an old geezer then, even, you know, and he said, so he didn't speak of gays or gay people. He said the gay. He said, you know, the gay. Said the gay. He had two gay sons. I have to tell you this. And one refused to talk with him, and the other one was fine. The one who refused to talk to him, it wasn't about gayness. It was, the guy was, you know, sort of messed up anyway, and had a grudge or something. Anyway, so you know, the gay, they come in all kinds. Some are wonderful, and some you can't stand. And I got one of each. That was Charlie Shedd. Well, so I'm just saying, masturbation can be understood as a gift of God. Your arm is just long enough. And I think that, though, in masturbation, people make a big mistake in fantasizing strangers and anonymous situations and so forth. Because there again, they're linking the orgasm with anonymity and novelty and so forth. You should link the brain in masturbation to what is going to be there with a partner. Not a fantasy partner, but the physical sensations that are going to be there. See, the nerve ending stimulation, the sensations, the breathing sensations, and so forth, the tension and tension release, and all of that is all part of the way in which God created your body. See, and that way you don't have to drag in all kinds of other stuff, you know. And my clients who practice this report that they actually have stronger orgasms than if they're thinking of all sorts of fantasies. So I think that that even in that, so don't reinforce by anonymous sex or masturbatory fantasies or porno or, you know, that sort of thing. But then when you're and those of you who have a thing on a Planet Out or anything like that, you know, describing yourself, don't be afraid to put in that you're an evangelical Christian that is serious about your faith. Because there are other people looking for that, you know. Now, don't forget, you know, some people just read right down through, you know, I mean, these clients who say, no smokers, you know. And this person's smoking like a fiend when he shows up on the doorstep, you know. So, and then there's a wonderful network that Justin Lee has put together. Who here has ever been on that network, gaychristian.net? Justin Lee is a great young guy and down in North Carolina, and started a little website called Justin's World when he was just 19. And now he's, I think, 26, and it's morphed into gaychristian.net, that's singular. because there's a bad one called gaychristians.net. But gaychristian.net. And it's amazing how many evangelical Christians are out there in little tiny towns by themselves. I mean, we had a guy coming through Justin's network, came to our Eastern Connection from a tiny town in Pennsylvania. I had never even heard of it, and I went to Penn State, called Pillow, Pennsylvania. I said, is that where Pillow Presbyterian is? Yeah. Have you ever heard of Pillow Presbyterian? It's where people who sleep in on Sunday mornings.
Yeah, it's like Bedside Baptist. I heard somebody say that one.
Mattress Methodist. Mattress Methodist, Bedside Baptist.
Pastor Sheets.
One more question.
I want to follow up kind of on that.
Well, he had his hand up and then you too. What?
I was just kind of wondering kind of what they were saying about if a relationship was started with sex, can you build on that relationship?
Well, yes. I mean, all is not lost. I'm just saying that if you've made the mistake of starting it on that level, then that has not helped. And but, you know, from here on, you know, as the other gentleman said, hadn't heard about some of this stuff, and so, but now from now on he had, so he's responsible for what he's heard.
You're responsible!
What?
But could she said something on Sunday or today?
Well, we try to be current, but...
How do you feel about multiple screenings? Just you're out there, you're interviewing, or whatever you want to call it, and you have a coffee date with a guy on Wednesday, and you have a coffee date with another guy on Saturday, and they both seem promising. I mean, is it okay to...
Yeah, yes, and I think, you know, you ought to be able to say to each, you know, I had a coffee date on Wednesday, and a coffee date today with you, and I like you both, and I'm going to have another coffee date with you, I hope, and another coffee date with you, you know, that sort of thing. That's fine. That practices honesty rather than duplicity. I think if you don't tell them about the other one, then not only are you misleading him and practicing misleading, you see, but you know yourself, you're being duplicit. And don't forget, if what you're looking for is eventual intimacy, duplicity is the exact opposite of intimacy. So whatever you can do to get rid of duplicity, you know, and part of what we do when we posture is duplicitous. You see. So now, I do think that you have to be careful that if you're screening somebody and you've now been seeing that person, on a number of occasions, and so the stranger is indeed becoming stranger and less the fantasy, but still seems like worth, you know, continuing to see, maybe a couple of months later. Then you see a brand new person in a coffee date. You're much less likely to tell this person that you're having a coffee date with. Okay. And that's going to be duplicitous, you see. Even if you say it. Person's going to personalize it, and even if he doesn't so personalize it, it's apples and oranges by that. So it's not a fair, you know, well, because this person, a lot more wrong with him now. See, nothing wrong with this one. So I think I'll go with this one. Big mistake. Because at least this one, you've had a couple of months to, you know, continue to screen them in. Well, I hear people applauding, so that's it.